This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies,
but we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights
and get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that rules upon high on the 40th floor. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I work for the building.
Hey, this is Chris, and heaven isn't real, stupid.
And this episode, we're discussing High Rise, starring Tom Hiddleston, Sienna Miller, Luke Evans, Elizabeth Moss, Jeremy Irons, and directed by Ben Wheatley. Gentlemen, I honestly didn't realize what we were getting ourselves into when we decided we're going to be doing this movie. And quite honestly, if I had, I probably would have been warning you about this movie before we started down this path. Out of curiosity, were any of you familiar with this movie or the classic novel this came from J.G. Ballard prior to watching it for this episode?
I swear I had read something about it, a little snippet here or there, but not really in depth about it.
I never read the novel, but this is my second time seeing the movie, and it still doesn't make sense. So, yeah.
All right, so I'll be honest here. I've heard about this movie. It was on my Netflix queue for practically from the moment I heard of it, because I heard that this is a really fucked up movie. But I honestly thought that, especially considering that it had Tom Hiddleston in it, you know, it wouldn't be too terribly crazy. If I had realized that this was based on a J.G. Ballard novel, that would have changed my tune altogether, because I did see the other film based on a J.G. Ballard novel before called Crash by a little-known director named David Cronenberg. Not the Academy Award-winning one, the one with the car crash sex play. Yeah. So I honestly did kind of underestimate this movie coming into it, and it didn't take me too long to realize that I seriously underestimated this movie. So let's go ahead and let's get into this, because this is a pretty thick film. For 2 hours, I feel like it felt like a 3 hour film in a 2 hour time slot. There is so much going on here, so much that is being said, and so many little things that are made into greater detail. So this is going to be a very interesting film to really kind of break down. But let's go ahead and let's start off with the weird setting that this film does, especially considering kind of the location that we're in, because most of the film takes place in a singular high rise, kind of in the same way of, like, I guess, like Dread. Had that same kind of thing to it. The Raid had that, you know, where we had one just specific location where everything is going on. There's another movie that I'm going to refer to in just a little bit that also had the same thing, that this film felt strangely akin to and would make a really weird double feature. And if you know which one I'm talking about, feel free to...
Maybe.
No.
Maybe. But depends how...
Well, let's put it this way. It's not going up, but it's going forward. That is the where things go.
Oh, yes, that one. Yes, yeah. Okay. I can see that, too.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get into that. But what did you think about this location, this high-rise specifically? What did you think of kind of how they set all this up and the kind of the geography of this high-rise?
You know, I'm surprised this isn't the middle finger of the hand. But...
I was surprised that it did look like a claw when you're looking at it from
It does look more like a claw.
When you look at it from the parking lot, especially when you have the pan, where you're seeing all the different towers all the different high rises. And I thought it was interesting that the one on the very end was under construction, so it's obviously smaller than the other four. Again, it was just those little details that I thought were very interesting in kind of the geography of this setting. But what did you think of kind of the fact that it was also crooked at the top, where it kind of goes up and then it gets to the very end and then it just kind of skewers a little bit? Do you think that that's kind of symbolic?
Of the upper crust being crooked and corrupt in there.
I mean, the entire building being crooked.
It sounded like a communist manifesto.
Kind of, yeah. You know. I mean, we kind of had this discussion when we were talking about Rosemary's Baby, where, you know, the setting and how the building itself plays this, you know, this huge part in kind of setting up what will be happening, right?
I see why, from a architectural point of view, you'd want a design like that, because it does give you that nice terrace that we see where people can sun themselves and have a balcony to look over. But it also kind of allows the higher-ups to just literally, they could just dump stuff on the people right below them.
As we'll...
Which we see in the first couple
minutes.
No,
it actually happens practically throughout the film, especially for the first half of the film. Which I found very interesting that, you know, that there's so much attention put onto things being thrown off of balconies. From the first thing that we see that's thrown off a balcony, which was a beer bottle, you know, it just constantly gets bigger and bigger and bigger until we have a guy throwing himself off the balcony.
Yeah. And then people throwing other people off the balconies.
But what about you, Chris? What did you think about this architecture?
I didn't catch that it was in the shape of a hand, which I thought was kind of cool the second time around. But after that initial concept, I didn't really think it played much into the movie that much, as far as like the palm concept went, you know?
Yeah. I also love, well, actually it was interesting. It was one of the throwaway lines in the film was where, Tom Hiddleston's character is talking to the architect and you see kind of the layout of the five buildings and he, you know, they kind of bring up that this is a hand and then he says like something about an evil vortex and goes, I'll take that.
Oh yeah.
A psychic phenomenon. It almost looks like you should be able to draw lines off the building and they'd form a pentagram.
Doesn't it look like it in the sketches? Like the parking lot almost looks
it does
like,
form
a- like this the center for psychic phenomenon, like kind of like a 3D version of the Ghostbusters building a little bit.
The Ghostbusters complex and Zool rise up from the middle.
Well, I mean, you have the little points at the end. Like, if all five of them were complete, like, they'll summon Beelzebub from the parking lot.
Yeah.
Summon up some sort of hedonistic, not destruction god, but, like, the party god of letting people die because you're partying too much. Yeah.
Well, let's be honest here. The parties that are going on in this place are extremely decadent. We're talking about hedonistic to the max.
Dying.
I mean, to the point where even rape is like, rape. I mean, who cares?
Just another Thursday.
I mean, literally, these are weekdays, and some of these people are going to work the next day. Like, somebody get that body off that car, because I'm sure that Chuck is going to want to drive himself in today. Like, what?
And that's even if they go into work, you know? It's like...
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, like especially like the layout of the building specifically, where you have, you have your restaurants, you have your supermarket, entertainment, all of it's in this building. You really don't need to leave the building for anything other than work. And I find it very interesting that you have fewer and fewer people going to work as the movie goes along. You know, fewer and fewer people are leaving, even to the point where at the very end, I don't think anyone's leaving that building, right?
No.
Nope. Mm-mm.
Or the ones who are leaving it have left it on an ethereal plane, let's put it that way, not a physical one. Yeah, let's put it this way.
Lang has left the building, even though Lang is still there. Lang is taking in new patients.
Eating dogs.
That's not Lang anymore. He doesn't even recognize himself in the first person. He is now one with the building.
Do you think all the support people ran screaming?
Yeah.
Because you still have, like, the grocery clerk is still at her station, except now she just speaks French.
Well, hey, I mean, that's what you do when you have nothing to do but to read a French book, you know, while...
Yeah.
Yeah, so... But what did you make of kind of how the layout of the social classes and how they're structured in this high rise? That you have the lower classes on the lower levels, and as you go up, the higher classes take over. You have, and there's three strata, right? There's low, middle, and elite, right?
Yeah.
And I want to say that everything over the grocery market is the higher end, the middle and the higher class. And then everything below that is the low class, right?
It feels like it's low class until 415, which is the supermarket. Middle class, maybe through floor 20, because that's where the squash courts are, and I can't see...
Poor people
much
playing
of the middle
squash.
Class being involved in squash.
Hey, this
I
is
can't
Britain.
Even really see the middle class playing
yeah,
it.
Is Britain, yeah.
It is possible.
I mean, it's possible, but you know that would imply it's British. They want an indoor cricket area.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's right next to the squash courts. To be honest,
you need a big area for cricket. You'd need the whole floor if you're going to do it. Two floors if you're doing it right, because you got the high. In fact, you should just have a cricket stadium outside, but that involves going outside.
Well, I find it interesting that the low-class entertainment center is located in the basement. You know, that's where the birthday party is.
Yeah.
Yet the swimming pool, which you would assume would be at the lowest ends, if I'm not correct, that's like it's actually upstairs.
It's on the border. I think it's on the border, one of the borders between, and that's why they're fighting over it.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and let's break this down, because I think that we could easily say that this is surrealism. This is in no shape, way, or form meant to be taken as literal. Like, this is something that could literally happen.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Do you...
I sort of see where it could, but at the same time, at least one person would be running screaming out there going, "Oh my God, get the cops!" Just one. All it would take is one person... I could see a group insanity going where you basically become gangs fighting over this. But
well, wouldn't you be more seeing protests, maybe some media, some, you know, having the news come out there and talk about this place? Because this is a high-end location. On top of that, even for, you know, for these kind of blocks, I don't believe that you will see rich people actively moving in with poor people, or allowing poor people to be in the same building as them, no matter.
Well,
this is just on the verge of Thatcher's Britain. You know, this is. I think
if you're selling it as the poor people work there,
but they're not working
they are
there.
The support they, staff
they,
the end.
They leave.
Some of them do.
They leave the complex to go to work. I mean, some of them work there, obviously, but
There is a movement for. There was a movement that I've heard of for an all-inclusive structure that nobody would ever have to leave. The only thing this building is missing for that would be its own hydroponic system to grow its own food.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if they had that, they might be fine. But
this isn't about sustaining. This is about capitalism. I mean, in fact, that's the final.
Right.
The final speech we're hearing of Margaret Thatcher is all about capitalism and how, you know, there's good capitalism, bad capitalism, you know. And so, no, this is meant to be a criticism of capitalism. So, no, you couldn't have there be a hydroponic, because then that would mean that this would be kind of closer to a utopic society. The whole idea is that this is askew, that this is... a capitalist utopia, where you can buy everything that you want. where where everything that, if you pay your rent, the poor can live with the rich, and that, but at the same time that the rich will basically, the rich are the first among equals, right? They get all of the stuff that they want at the expense of others.
Yeah.
Simply just because they have more, right? What do you think?
And technically, I think they'd be paying less for some stuff overall, unless it's a flat rate for everything.
Well, that's why I'm saying that we shouldn't be taking this as literal, because this can't. Yeah. This would not work on a literal basis. This would have to be done as a metaphorical or surrealistic. And considering that we've done surrealism earlier with Wayne's World, specifically, and last year we did Playtime, which was also kind of surrealistic. What do you find this off-putting? Do you find this to be annoying, or kind of, are you digging this aspect of the film?
I was taking too much of it more literal, because it was reminding me of some science fiction settings, to be honest.
Well, it definitely reminded me of one as I was watching it that I'd actually seen just a couple of years before, and one that at some point we're eventually going to get to, although I think that it's going to be like one of the very last episodes we ever do, which is Snowpiercer.
Right. Yeah.
Snowpiercer is basically kind of going in the same direction, right? You have the classes that are separated, but instead of it being floors, and this would be cars, they're kind of forced to live with one another. The lower ends are kind of getting tired of being treated by the higher ends, and the higher ends are getting upset because they don't believe that they're given the proper respect from the lower classes that they believe that they've earned, that they deserve, even though they've never really earned it. You have this kind of fight for the control of this location, and that means getting to the conductor, or in this case, the architect. With the interesting last name of Royal, of all things, or is it his first name?
I think it's just his name is Royal.
And do you find it very interesting that this is set in Britain with the head person named Royal? Just saying. Don't think that this is meant to be literal.
And it's the same queen from this time this book was written to now. So, long live the queen.
All right. So, what about you, Chris? What are you getting from all of this? Do you find it to be more literal, more surreal? Do you find it off-putting? I know that you've kind of not been so big on this before.
I want to like this movie, but so much of it doesn't add up for me, And I feel like that about all of Ben Wheatley's stuff. But I guess I could see this. I took it literally more than anything, but I see that it's pretty much not. But when I first watched it, I was thinking everything was contained in the building, which I think would have made things a bit more interesting. I thought Lang's office was in the building, and it didn't
I did too, but the more I thought about it, especially between the two viewings that I had for this film, the more I realized that one of the whole points that the film is making is that people are no longer leaving the building. And so they have to leave the building in order to make that point. So, they should have a life outside the building. They should be coming into this building. I mean, hell, the first thing we see is him moving into the building, which means that he obviously had to have a life outside the building.
Right.
And so having that, and for him to basically remove himself from society to, embody the hedonism and the corruptive nature of this building, and to kind of see that he has to leave the building, he has to have something that should pull him away, some reality that's pushing him out, but that system is failing him. They aren't caring about him. One of the interesting things, his secretary is constantly going on about, you look this way, you look that way, but she's concerned about him, but she's not concerned enough to kind of call out that something's going on here. Like one of the times that he's in his bloodstained suits, I'm wondering, is he going out like that? Because one thing that I find very interesting is that he's actually working out in these suits. He plays squash in these suits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he lives in the suit.
The only time you see him not in the suit is when he's sunbathing. Yeah,
and he's fully naked.
Which is in his bathing suit.
Yeah.
Bathing suit, though. See?
Well, birthday suit.
He never switches to a bathing suit.
Whatever. Well, I'm just saying. I mean, let's be honest here. I'm pretty sure that there were a few individuals who probably were trying to go frame by frame to see if you saw little Hillston run around there. Just saying. But not that I'm doing that, mind you. But there are probably some out there.
Oh, trust me, I'm sure. I've met the Hillston fanatics.
He definitely
if they haven't heard of this movie, they will be soon.
There you go. But the only time that he's out of that suit is the first time we see him sunbathing, and so I find it very interesting that
he has sex in that suit.
I'm just saying
that was so awkward. That was so weird. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he
and then he goes and paints in it.
Well, he gets the paint all over it too, I guess also is kind of a symbolic thing in itself, which we'll be getting into. Yeah, this thing plays huge on symbolism. There's tons of symbolic elements going throughout this entire film, especially when it comes to the walls specifically, but. Also, I guess let's go ahead and let's break this down. So we kind of brought up our main protagonist, which is Dr. Lang, who's played by Tom Hiddleston. He kind of comes into this building. It's interesting that our first signs of him are kind of look like it's a post-apocalyptic, doesn't it? I mean, the first scene in the film, everything's all torn up. And
it's flashback or flash forward. This movie is flashback. Yeah.
So I think it's also interesting that we see him eat a dog, which
warning, a dog dies.
Well, you don't see him actually kill
and a horse. And a horse.
Yeah.
Who cares about the horse? We care about the dog. Even though there are multiple dogs in this film, that bad stuff happens.
If you're a dog, you're just fucked in this movie. I think so.
Let's just say that there is a lot of animalistic behavior, and the animals aren't the ones doing the animalistic behavior. But I find it very interesting how it starts off with that, and then we go 3 months, which part of me kind of laughs at, because you couldn't think, like, how could things get this bad in 3 months? How, I mean, unless there's, like, a nuclear war, right?
Yeah.
And...
All of society forgets this building even exists. Which is odd, because they still get mail delivery. And yet, the mailman doesn't go...
Well, this is the British mail service, so they've probably seen worse.
I don't... Yeah.
Just saying.
I don't think so. Yeah. I'm sure the British mail service would have go, oh my god, I gotta tell somebody about this.
But they probably
did. This place went downhill fast.
And it got... lost in the mail.
Caught up in bureaucracy. Yeah. Oh no. We apologize for any insults to the British Mail Service by Eric this evening. Please send your complaints to...
Yes, by all means, bring it on. Bring it on. But no, all the same, though. So we have... All of this goes tits up in 3 months. When we see it go back and we see the building, and we see that this is kind of... both modern, this kind of, not even modern, kind of postmodern, right? This is the kind of thing that you would see in, like, hotels, where everything is kind of built into the walls, and, it's all very sleek and stylish and kind of sexy steel kind of look to it, right?
The condo look of,
And then you find yourself going, wait a second, hold on. Why is it that everybody's smoking everywhere? Why?
Because it's the 70s.
Well, we don't know that. It's not like it comes out and says it's the 1970s. You have to actually piece that out from all the information you're getting.
That's true.
You know, I mean, it's from the clothing. It's from the music that's being played. It's the fact that no one has any modern technology on them. It's the the fact that even pregnant women are drinking and smoking to an extent that, no, that are you surprised when they say, I'm sorry about the head? You know, just saying, you know, but yeah, it'll be, you, you're, this is, you know, the, but you have to piece that out. So everything, so there's this kind of off kilter thing. And part of me kind of thought that what if this is kind of like a futurist, you know, kind of a 70s ideal of the future. There was a movie that came out a couple of years ago. I think it was called Space Station 1979 or something, where it was kind of like it was set in the future. It was spent on a space station, but it was kind of like the 70s version of a space station.
How the 70s would view a modern... How the 70s thought the 2000s would be, kind of thing.
Well, it's actually pretty interesting. It's kind of boring. I'll tell you this. It's kind of done like a melodrama. Yeah. But it's interesting kind of the visual style of the film and the fact that it kind of goes with this kind of shag and free love kind of color scheme for that. Where we're here, you know, this definitely has the browns and the muted... bright colors, right? This is not a very colorful building, but it's distinctly 70s feel, right? Or are you not really sure even going through this film?
Some of it could have been 60s, but yeah, the hair, between haircuts, suit design, but you, that would be something you'd have to know is 70s. You know it's not 80s.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the hair hasn't hit yet. And you know it's not 90s because...
well, it's also very interesting that we don't get any pop culture references. We get some music, you know, there's some music cues here. Specifically, a particular band we'll be talking about in just a second. But we don't get TV callbacks. We don't get pop culture callbacks. You know, no one's talking about, you know, crazy things that are happening or, you know, things that would kind of date the film. Right, there's nothing. There's none of that. It's kind of, in that sense, timeless in that element, right?
I think the writer of the original novel, if you base it off of what I've seen in the film, could probably call it anywhere between the 50s and the 70s.
Well, I think
and say maybe late.
Ballard intended it to be modern for his time because this was written in 1970. Which is 75. And one of the interesting aspects that should be brought up about the film is that the producer is Jeremy Thomas. Now, we've actually talked about Jeremy Thomas before last year when we talked about the Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor, because he is Bertolucci's main producer. But he's also a major big deal in British film. And he's been around, well, since the 60s. And Jeremy Thomas has been trying to get this movie filmed. He actually got the rights before the novel came out. And he's been trying to get this made for nearly 40 years.
40 years, yeah.
So he has pushed this thing. This thing has gone through so many versions. So many filmmakers were going to do this, and it just fell apart before, you know, went to filming. And quite honestly, I'm not surprised that it took a Doctor Who director to get this off the ground.
Yeah.
Just saying. I'm not surprised.
Yes, To cross over with the other shows on the Gunna Geek Network, but yeah, the director of this movie did two episodes for the Capaldi, at the beginning of the Capaldi run. He did the first Capaldi episode, and then he did the first Capaldi Dalek episode. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I'm only seeing that now, but I kind of want to go back and rewatch those episodes to see if he can kind of.
I do too, but after I see his latest film, which is coming out later on this month, which we might bring up a bit, just a little bit later. But what about you, Chris? What are you getting from the kind of the vibe of this? And do you kind of see the super the science fiction aspects? I mean, you kind of brought that up a bit before.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting the 70s vibe before I. Like pieced it all together and like read that it was actually set in the 70s and the movie's giving you cues that it's actually from the 70s and all that. But like the dancing also seemed very 70s to me, or like the dream Lang has when he's like, what is he dancing with, like the stewardesses in red or whatever. Yeah, that just seemed very...
Was that a dream?
That was a dream. I don't think we've actually seen those stewardesses again, so I'm going to take it that it's a dream sequence.
Yeah, maybe.
I took it as a dream because he went to sleep, he's snoring, and then you see the dream, and then you see him waking up. So I took it as a dream.
Let's just be honest here. That is a pretty awesome shot. I mean... Look at it this way.
It really was.
If I were like an advertiser, I would take that shot and put something, my product in that shot somewhere, and it would fit. No matter if it's cognac or electronics or, you know.
A certain airline changes their uniforms to that scheme and then uses that scene to save their airline because they're having a bad time.
Oh, we're
right
dating
now.
This episode.
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah.
But yeah, come fly the friendliest guys with Tom Hiddleston. Oh yeah, you know that would sell. But that's a great shot though. I love that dream sequence. I actually love almost all of the dancing sequences that we have here, which brings me to the actor that I really want to talk about with this movie, Luke motherfucking Evans. Holy shit. I've
for the first time not looking like somebody else that we know.
Okay, so let's just call it out right here. Luke Evans, I think Kent, that you're specifically, you're familiar with him probably with the Fast and Furious, and you're probably familiar with him with the Hobbit specifically.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him with Fast and Furious, but yeah, definitely Hobbit.
And of course, you'd seen him in Beauty and the Beast, I believe so.
Right.
Okay, now I had heard from other podcasts that when he's, you know, when he is the guy who's starring, you know, he's the star of the movie, this guy's bland. But when you give him a supporting role, he will kick ass. Especially the crazier he gets to act, the better he is.
Yeah.
I've seen him as Gaston. I have seen him here. I fucking believe it. Now I want to see everything that this guy has ever done because I honestly, if he does even half the shit that he does in other movies, that's going to be awesome. Because he kills this movie. Every time that he's on, he is the most interesting person that you're seeing on that frame. He just draws you in. You just want to see what he's going to do next because he's going to do some crazy ass shit, right? And if I'm wrong, please tell me. But I am just drawn to this guy, and this character is just insane.
Oh, I like that he's so insane. But then Lang is like, he's the sanest person in the building, and it's like, oh,
he's right.
At that particular point, let's be honest here, he's starting to talk to the walls. I mean, when he's saying he's the sanest person in the building, he's also referring to himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would try and argue with that and say, no, some of the women are acting sane, but wait a minute, they're not grabbing their kids and just running. So, yeah, maybe they're insane too. So.
Just saying. But no, Luke Evans, though, my God, he just, it's like, you know, because the first time I saw him was, I believe it was when he was in Fast and Furious 6, Fast and Furious 6, and then he was doing the Hobbit movies, and you know, he just kind of was just blah, you know, in those movies. I mean, I still like the movies for the most part, but he's kind of blah in it. And to come off of that and to see him just like tearing shit up and acting the wild man, and you know, both charismatic and dangerous, and part of it is kind of sexy, part of it is kind of pathetic. He's just, I mean, he draws you in. He just, like, you kind of want to know what he's going to do next. While at the same time, you also want to beat the shit out of the guy because, you know, this guy's a piece of shit, right? I mean, he gets all these emotions out of you.
Well, hell, everybody's cheating on everybody else in this movie, and he's doing it right in front of his wife. Oh, he's lost focus.
It's the
focus
key party without the keys,
Kent.
I mean, we talked about this with Ice Storm.
I know. Well, that was a key party with keys. This one,
they don't need the fucking keys. Everyone lives right next to each other.
Well, this is like,
and yet they still lock their doors at night.
Yeah.
This is like the most captivating he's ever been, like as far as the movies I've seen him in. Because before, he's been like really dull or like just over the top, like in The Raven, where I think that was John Cusack as Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
And then he was like some detective who's just like, he gets shot and just like totally Nicolas Cages it and just like, he's over the top.
I fucking love Nicolas Cage when he Nicolas Cages shit. So I take offense to that because that's like saying that's a bad thing. That is not a bad thing. And especially
it was
with
here.
The right actor, that is actually very exciting. Because I would prefer to see a batshit crazy performance in a bad movie than a great performance in a bad movie, because it's just going to get devoured. Because everything else is bad, you're not going to really care if that performance is great. But if you have batshit crazy, then it just makes it just pop out. And you find yourself just like, okay, I can get behind this. And so, I don't know, I can't follow you there, man. I can't follow you.
Well, it was also almost The Crow, so that would have been interesting. So
I don't know, because that would have been a lead performance. And they would probably try to downplay it, make him more emo. And we've seen him emo. We don't want him emo. I would prefer him being like the main villain in the Crow movie.
Okay.
I would prefer him to be the one that could basically just, you know, go out with his hair on fire, especially the long ass hair. I mean, that's like when I brought up like Beauty and the Beast, because that movie was bad. But every time that he was on, I've never cared for Gaston in any shape, way, or form before, but he made me care for Gaston. So holy shit, that is saying a lot about what this guy can do. And like I said, after this movie, I gotta see everything he's ever done. I gotta find all of this crazy stuff. Because apparently this guy is the shit, and I think I've caught on to this at this point. So I gotta find it.
Okay.
But are there any other performances that you find captivating or that you find interesting? You know, we do have some other actors here that are definitely trying to ham it up a bit in their own rights, right?
Like, I couldn't figure out the motive of the architect. He was just, like, fucking with everybody just to fuck with them. That's what it seemed like to me.
Oh, yeah. He's the elite of the elite.
He's
the king.
He's a dick.
He can do what he wants.
I don't think that he's intentionally a dick. I think primarily what he is that he just wants to see his masterpiece. He wants to think of himself as this godlike figure, but the thing is that he really... he doesn't care. And I think that's something that we see throughout the film, because one thing that is interesting about this high rise, nothing works.
Yeah.
I mean, he calls it, you know,
it breaks down quickly.
What does he say?
Yeah.
Is it that it's
settling?
Yeah, settling. Like
settling. No,
no, shit don't work.
That's not how big buildings work.
I mean, you know, that's why I say that we don't, that these people aren't working for the building, because if they did, then this shit would be working now, wouldn't it? You know, elevators
you people on the lower floors are using up too much of the electricity. No, that's a wiring issue. That would be a wiring issue, if anything.
You know,
because don't tell me that the whole place is going to go out because... two poor people flipped on light switches simultaneously in the first floor. No! That should not cause this.
Yes. But again, this is one of the reasons why you can't say that this is literal, because, you know, because they treat electricity like people treat, like they treat a straw.
Running water.
You know, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Although, if they would have gone Black Mirror and you had, like, a room in the basement where everyone was in these treadmills or, you know, these giant hamster wheels, you know, powering it up. Now, I could get behind
that. They do at the end,
though.
They
do at the end, yeah.
They kind of do at the end when they're at...
Oh, spoilers.
They have the final encounter upstairs and the women are trying to figure something out. And one of them's on a treadmill powering... one for his one light bulb so that the others could go, huh, what about this? Nope.
Oh boy. But But no, I mean, but yeah, the architect, you know, the thing is that he wants to be this grand designer, but the thing is that he really just doesn't care. And I think that, I think maybe, again, we're looking at it from a symbolic level, that he's talking about the monarchy, again, with the whole name royal. You know, the monarchy really doesn't care. The monarchy doesn't really have the power that they think, or that people kind of give to him. I mean, what happens when Luke Evans shoots him? I mean, he's devoured by his subjects, you know, his harem, so to say. You know, nothing changes. It still keeps plummeting. And I think that that's something that that is intended with that imagery. You know, considering, again, we have Jeremy Irons. Now, maybe it would have been more poignant if it were not Jeremy Irons, but you know, a queen, so to say, as royal. Again, considering that this would be the age of Elizabeth and Thatcher, you know, you could make those ties.
It doesn't work with the profession. It doesn't work with the profession, no. It has to be a guy who's running the show.
But why? Again, he's talking about
the 70s? Would you accept it?
But, I mean, the thing is, though, is that especially in this particular period, women are running the show in Britain. You know, it's Elizabeth II that's the monarch. Yeah, it's Maggie Thatcher who's running the parliament.
But this is still the upper crust of society, and this is the architect.
Yes.
You're not going to see a woman architect in this position of power.
But we did. That's the thing. I mean, like I've mentioned, we have women in
As a literal architect, not a political architect.
But even he says that he's interested, that he was trying to create a political,
he's creating a political
station in these buildings. You know, that it was as much political as it was structural. You know, he was trying to develop a perfect society inside of these buildings. And
he failed miserably. Or did he?
Oh, no. I mean, he failed. Even he sees it. But the thing is, though, is that especially when you fail, especially to this magnitude, there's not a whole lot that you can do now, can you? It isn't as though you can just erase everything going, nope, we're going to do it. We're going to change it all right now.
Well, I don't know, though. From a very bizarre, uncaring point of view, it may have been successful after it imploded. After it goes boom and a bunch of people die, what's left?
It's a dystopia.
Forms a... the only thing keeping it from being a utopia is their ability to generate food, which they may be working on.
Well, I mean, again, then let's go ahead and let's talk about the differences between a utopia and dystopia. Because in all essences, all utopias are flawed. Because there's no way on earth that you're going to have total agreement with all subjects. Someone is going to not like it. And as soon as that dissent arises, then it's immediately that person's dystopia. So,
unless you're a total dictatorship.
Yeah. So you could say that it was utopic at one point to a certain class, but as we've seen, that class is downtrodden on the lower classes. So when the lower classes basically eradicate the higher classes, and that all of them are now insane, it does create inequality. So it becomes utopic in its dystopia. I know I'm probably making people cross-eyed with this right now, but
nope. Yeah, I'm following you perfectly. So.
But what do you think, Chris? Do you think that this is a utopia dystopia type of argument, or is this more kind of meant to be satirical?
I think I'm one of the people that went cross-eyed when you started talking about it. So,
so Kent, were there any other characters that you found interesting that really kind of stood out to you? I know you brought up Elizabeth Moss a little earlier. You know, was there anything that you found very fascinating about this particular character, considering that she's probably the most innocent character in this movie, so to say? I mean, she's the one that's, you know, trying to, you know, be agreeable and trying to do right by others, with the exception of the fact that she's smoking and drinking while heavily pregnant.
I Well, she's the one that puts out the facade of innocence. I think she understands a lot about what's going on and how bad it is. The most innocent, I think, is the little kid.
Well, I get what you're saying there.
I think even towards the end, he's getting the idea of what's going on.
Yeah, loss of innocence, so to say.
So, yeah. But yeah, the problem with Elizabeth Moss is I'm looking at her and I'm like, I know this person, I know this person, I know this person, I know this person. And like, I just did a West Wing rewatch. Mm-hmm. I finished up not that long ago. Like, and here I am associating her with Mad Men. Like, wait, that's where she's from. It's like, no, it's like she's from, yeah, not to geek sheet too early, but it's like, brain, start working.
I know what you mean. There are several actors and actresses in this movie that I had that go through.
Oh, we'll geek sheet later, but still, damn.
I know what you mean. All right, so bringing up references. Okay, there is one song that was used twice. Now, normally, if you hear a song, especially when it comes from the 70s, you think that it's just atmosphere. But the fact that they used this song twice in two different variations is very interesting. And neither are the actual original versions. You had the song SOS by ABBA that was used. The first one was a Muzak version that you got in the...
That's why I don't notice it.
Huh?
Okay. That's why I didn't notice it. Because it was Muzak and I was tuning it out.
Well, part of me is just like, why did I know this song? Why did I know the song? And then it was... Yeah. I was actually after the second time when you had the cover band do the version of SOS. And it's like, oh, that's that song. But we had SOS played twice. Now, SOS came out in 1976. So it could be used as a kind of as a placemat for that. On top of that, though, the song does kind of, especially if you hear the lyrics, it could be kind of an indication of a warning of the deterioration of this place, right?
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the song, though, to know all the lyrics, to know if something is, like, key, oh my god, why didn't we notice it? But yeah, SOS for this whole society is sinking.
Mm-hmm.
The ship of state is going down.
I get you.
Yeah.
But
I was going to... Sorry. Okay, yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
But no, I just... I thought this was kind of something fascinating, because normally the only time that you would hear a song twice in a soundtrack is if it has some sort of heavier meaning. You know, it's like, well, we'll probably be talking about that later on when we get to another song, another movie that's based on a song that we'll be doing, I think, next month. But again, I find it very fascinating here that this is a song that does kind of give the indication of, I mean, hell, it's even right in the title, SOS. You know, this is a, you know, this is a dire situation. This is a warning, and yet it's not being heard. You know, maybe it is because it's a Muzak version and it's being drowned out. You don't realize that this is a sign. But out of curiosity, though, were there any other kind of metaphorical or any other indications of things that are happening that you thought were kind of indications of things that are kind of going crazier, that are bad things that are going to be coming?
Well, right at the very beginning, when Lang first moves in, it's almost like he's hugging the building. He's wandering around his new apartment, and there's support pillars that he's walking up to, and he's, like, putting his arms around them.
Oh,
which is, like, weird, okay, but... I mean, they're in weird spots, but that's kind of a weird behavior.
I won't say that I go around hugging my walls, but in a way I can understand, especially if you have a new space that is completely foreign to you, that, yeah, you will kind of want to... feel more a part of it, I guess.
unless you're measuring to see if the shelves will fit all around this pillar that you plan to put up. But, oh, I know if I reach like this, it, my shelving unit will fit. Like, no.
That's not but exactly that was, how that works.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah.
Now, it would have been more fitting if he ended the movie hugging the walls.
Now, has when he's with the students and he's peeling off the mask off the skull,
mm-hmm.
that's like, okay, if we peel off the mask of society off these people in the building and see what's underneath, and then we have to drill in to see how crazy they really are.
Well, I think that there's you know, one of the indications of the film, and I want to leave it up to some other people have analyzed this film for kind of bringing up the fact that this is another one of those metaphorical things that he is a physiologist, right? This is a guy who is looking at the inner workings of the brain, while at the same time, he's having his own psyche basically being pummeled by everything that's going on in this building, right?
Yeah.
And there's indications throughout the film where they tie what's happening with him to skulls, specifically, to the skulls and heads that you see throughout the film, which I find very fascinating. There are other kind of visual cues that we get, things that kind of come back, very subtle things at times. And I don't want to go into those specifically because I think that there are other people who have tackled those a lot better than I ever could. But for me specifically, I did find it very fascinating how all of these little road signs kind of give us the indication of how crazy things are going and kind of the roadmap to the ending, where we have one party that ties into another party that ties into the apocalypse, so to say. You know?
We must out-party them. And by out-party, we mean...
We have to take everything. Like, you know, it's not just that we... It's not just that we have to do a better party. We have to take from them. We have to take their shit for our party.
Right.
So that we show them who's boss. It's all about control and power, you know?
Right.
And I
we're richer, so we have to go in. Like, what? If you're richer, you should just be able to buy it, not steal it. So.
Well, that's what they do. They buy it. Yeah. But they need to make sure that people can't buy it themselves. They have to buy it before the other person buys it. You know, it's like they even fight over a can of paint for crying out loud. And that's not something they were going to need for the party, because especially since that paint is what, gray? Like, I don't know what you would do with gray paint for a party, but say what you want about that one.
Well, God knows with all their debauchery, they've got to come up with something.
Oh, boy.
They will figure something out.
Like, we'll find some debaucherous thing to do with gray paint. There's got to be something we can do here.
We'll paint ourselves as gray trolls and then have an orgy. There we go.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm trying to think here. What aspects of the film kind of strikes out at you? What are the things that really gave you that what the fuck feeling?
You know, some of this, a lot of the what the fuck kind of reminds me of other British things. That's like when the British go nuts in a book or a piece of fiction, they go nuts. Some of the nutsness reminded me of, dang it.
Monty Python?
I keep forgetting the name of the book. Lord of the Flies.
Ah.
About the upper crust kids that crash on an island and all go nuts and kill each other.
Well, that is definitely an apt comparison.
Comparison, oh yeah. I'd like to check the history of one game I used to... I'm going to bring in other sci-fi universes for a second here. And just compare the way the building is set up. We've already made the comparison to Dread,
mm-hmm.
the Judge Dread universe, where you have big buildings that are people live in and have gang wars within the building,
mm-hmm.
which is also kind of mirrored in Dune, from my understanding, on some of the background for that, how some of the planets just have big city buildings, which got copied into copied, stolen into the Warhammer 40K universe, which becomes the gangs who fight.
Well, that's the thing. I think that this is something that's interesting to British life, though, because this is something that we actually that I've seen in several different British stories, not only here, but you know, we did mention Dread, which was based on, you know, it was a British comic book, that you know, and this is kind of a totalitarian European style of government that's in that particular world. We also see stuff like this in another movie that we may or may not get to at some point called Attack the Block.
Yes, I was about to bring that up. Yeah.
Yeah. you know, so Block Lifestyle does have kind of this connotation. I think that a part of that is what Ballard was going for in the book. And I think that's what Wheatley is kind of doing here. I think also one of the appealing things about this premise to Ben Wheatley as a filmmaker, and I'm kind of assuming here, but I think this is a valid assumption here, which is that the idea of a block, the blocks require that there's a uniformity in kind of the building, right? Every room, or basically every flat in a building, is pretty much the same. Yet at the same time, though, you can tell that there are differences from the poor to the rich, not by the room itself, so to say. It's basically the same room, but that what they do with that room, right? What they have in that room. And so he could take one room and he could dress it up in any shape, way, or form. Because, I mean, for budgetary reasons, all he has to do is just redecorate the same room and constitute it as someone else's room. And that way he saves money. That way he doesn't have to, build a whole lot of sets for different rooms, right?
Rent the same room. Because I kind of get the feeling that maybe these are real apartments somewhere.
No, this was definitely a set. Definitely a set.
Okay.
There's no way that this is an actual location. On top of that, considering the lot, most times, even when they say that it's based on a real location, they don't because they have to knock out walls for people to get behind. Because there's only so much room that you can have with a camera, and you have grips, you have your cameramen, you have your sound people, technicians all over the place, and they need places. And it's not just one person and the camera. And this definitely isn't that kind of independent film. This is slightly more, I don't want to say big budget, because this is still kind of on an independent budget, but it still requires a professional camera crew or professional film crew to do, right?
Yeah.
But no, but at the same time, though, I think it's very fascinating what, visually speaking, you can do with this type of premise, especially considering that this is kind of a sociological look at all the insanity that occur, especially in British lifestyle. And I think that this is a very British film. I think this is dealing with something that's very prominent to British people specifically. And I think that this gives people outside of Britain an opportunity to kind of get an idea of what is going on in the British mindset specifically. And maybe just not, I mean, I think primarily it's about the 70s specifically, but perhaps this could also be looked at on a modern take, when it comes to the class system. Because even though class has kind of been reduced in prominence in British society, it's still there, right? And so I think that this is kind of trying to find that middle ground of saying something that was important in the 70s and why it's still kind of important today.
Yeah.
Anyway. So
it's crazy.
Let's talk about the ending. Let's look at this, because with all the insanity that has occurred, all the death and destruction and mayhem I find it very fascinating. One of the antagonists on the rich side is this obnoxious, I want to say that he's like a head of TV programming. He becomes the man with his head in the TV.
Oh, he's a newsreader.
Oh, the newsreader, yes.
He's a newsreader, which makes me wonder, didn't anybody notice him disappearing?
It's Britain. They probably found someone like the next day.
Yeah, but you did at least go, somebody should be going, there's a lot of professionals who live in this building that just haven't shown up to work. Wow.
No, that's true. All right. So, anyway, but no, I think it's very fascinating, though, that our main protagonist goes completely mental. You know, he loses it.
Yeah.
He associates himself with the building. He's talking to the building. He's become basically the leader of this building, maybe. I don't know.
He takes over the top floor. He does take over the top floor.
Well, I don't know if he takes over the top floor, but he definitely takes the painting from the top floor. I think that you know, he probably still has it in his flat. That his flat becomes the new center of government of this building.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Because we don't know how many survivors there are by the time it gets down to him.
That's true. Anyway.
I figure the... it still boggles my mind that they leave the kids there and they don't just evacuate them and go, wait a minute, there's still an outside world.
Yeah. All right, I hate to do this, but I have to call time. I'm going to put you on mute because I'm going to go to the bathroom and I really don't think you want to hear that.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I have to do this. I have to do this.
You got to go.
I'm going to mute you, though. I'll be right back.
Yeah. No. Oh. Coming this December, Star Wars. I better not have to watch Luke Skywalker die with my own two eyes, I swear to God. Coming to a theater near you. I still have to watch New Doctor. In other words, oh, this movie needed a song and dance number. Just kidding. Just filling up audio all the time. On my recording. Oh. And did nobody notice all those cars in the parking lot? Just okay.
Sorry about that.
Fascinating. Okay.
All right. Okay, let's get back to this real quick. So at this particular point, actually, we could probably go on about this for about the next half hour. I just realized there's so much going on in here. But is there anything specifically that you think that we should really bring up?
Static shots were an interesting choice.
I thought that was a very unique thing, that the fact that the film doesn't use a whole lot of pans and a whole lot of moving shots. I thought that was something that was definitely an aesthetic choice. It kind of reminded me of Kubrick a little bit, which yes or no on that, because
kind of the style of how it would have been filmed in the 70s too. If you go by that.
A little.
Because the modern would be, oh, we have a fight, somebody's beating on someone, let's do quick movement, camera shakes, and yeah.
Well, that's one thing, but they did have they did have moving cameras in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, there were track shots and stuff like that, but the use of the static shot definitely kind of, it gave it a stiffness. It kind of created this air of kind of like a painting in a way, I think, which is kind of art house bullshit to an extent, but at the same time, you know, but it does kind of give you this kind of eeriness that the camera doesn't move as often. You know, it kind of gives you that stiffness that definitely kind of puts you on edge a bit. You know, but that's really pretty much, I mean, it doesn't take away from the film, in that sense, but it is kind of interesting. But anyway, I think we'll go ahead and call call it here. But before I do, though, I know that we have a geek sheet. This is a pretty...
We have a geek book. This is not a sheet. This is a book.
We got some Marvel. We got some DC. We've got some... Hell, we got some IDW in here.
Some President of the United States stuff. We got some Tolkien. We got some...
Yep. All right, so I'll let you throw in what you got, and then I'll hit the points that you miss.
Well, I made a post on Tumblr earlier. Oh, look, Loki's having sex with one of the Bartlett girls. I'm like, what? Yeah, you got Tom Hiddleston as Loki. You got Jeremy Irons as Bruce Wayne as Alfred. So it's Butler. Luke Evans sitting there being Luke Evans, of course. Bard of Lake Town. Moss being Elizabeth Moss from I just finished a West Wing marathon rewatch and like, oh yeah, duh. And I know I'm missing people. I know there's got to be more here. I mean, we already mentioned the director having done Doctor Who before and like, holy crap. It's like, could this film be more British? Or could this film be more geek-sheety? Ah, I'm sure you'll find something. Go!
I've got quite a bit, actually. So yeah. You brought up Elizabeth Moss. She's on that Netflix show, Top of the Hill. Top of the Lake. Sorry. Okay. Which I actually saw a couple episodes. It's really good. I'm still got a ways to go on that show. But, all right, so you brought up Hiddleston and Irons. I'm surprised you didn't mention that he was Scar in The Lion King, for crying out loud. Sienna Miller, who is actually part of the G.I. Joe universe.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, she was the Baroness. Surprised you missed that one. See, James Purefoy, who was in The Following, you know, he's... kind of roguishly, devilishly handsome. He played Mark Antony in Rome. Recently, he was in Trollhunters, you know, the animated Netflix show with Anton Yelchin. R.I.P. on that one. Let's see here. I mean, we did kind of bring up some of the creds from the director Ben Wheatley, who has a film coming out this month called Free Fire, which is being produced by Martin Scorsese with My Lady Love Brie Larson. So, gotta throw that tie in there.
Yeah.
Let's see here. And there's quite a bit more. The score was done by Clint Mansell, who most notably did the score for Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan and Moon, and recently he did the score for the Ghost in the Shell remake, I wasn't a big fan of the movie, but the score was actually pretty decent. Anyway, so yeah, that's just a bit of the stuff on that. So, all right, let's go ahead and let's call it. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on High Rise? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
I really want to like High Rise and Ben Wheatley as a director, because his films always have interesting concepts, and he knows how to bring visuals to life with like really, really vivid and dynamic style. And he brings that to High Rise, and the performances are interesting, and there's enough symbolism and concepts to intrigue you, but the film doesn't really capitalize on that, which is weird to say since it's a film about, you know, capitalism. But I don't know, it's just, it didn't really add up for me. Luke Evans is amazing, I'll give you guys that. And it's an interesting film to look at, but when you try to like process it, it leaves you wanting more. So I mean, I don't hate it, and I don't love it, so I gotta give it a maybe.
Kent!
Oh, I'm having a tough time with it, because, you know, you want to see this film as grounded in reality. The problem is, it becomes a metaphor or a fable more than grounded in reality. And they don't kind of give that to you. You kind of have to figure that out on your own. And as a realism, I can't say it, but there's such great performances in this that if you just want to see the actors just act, then it's great. But there's so many plot holes if you want to view it as a realistic movie that you're like, no. So I would say it's one of those maybes, and that maybe is if you're interested in any of the actors in this film and how good they are, which means you're probably going to want to see it because, oh, hey, it's this person, and this person all interact. Yeah, let's do this for these actors. But if you're not into that, then yeah, you're probably going to want to skip it. So I'm doing a definite maybe on it.
So for me, I'll be honest here. This is material that's been done before. I think that it was kind of it was done before in other type of movies. It was even done in a Doctor Who episode. Back in Paradise the Towers. I want to say it was the Sylvester McCoy era that did this premise before. That said, I actually, it's one of those movies that I kind of appreciate. And it's not so much the territory that it's going with, but the characters. And I think it's the characters that really set this apart from other movies that have done this type of thing before. Because they are so fascinating. And the acting done here is so well done. Most notably, Luke Evans and Tom Hiddleston specifically. Are so interesting in this movie that I really do find it fascinating. And I do kind of appreciate where this is going. And I think that the critics were right in getting, you know, in saying that this is actually a pretty unique piece of filmmaking. It's not the best. It's not really original in that sense. But stylistically and acting-wise, it's impressive enough that I seriously think that people need to give it a shot, and they really need to, you know, just try it. And so I'm going to go ahead and give it a pass. I wasn't really sure if I was going to pass it or not, but the more I think about it, the more that I find myself really appreciating what was done with the material, the more I find that I really support what this film was going for. And so, yeah, I'm definitely going to give this a pass. So, now we have come to the end of the month, and I just realized we haven't gotten around to the Best Picture winner yet. So, I think that we should be getting around to that on our next episode. What do you think?
Well, if I have the right envelope in front of me, I can't quite tell. What's this say again?
we'll find out when we open that envelope next week. But gentlemen, I appreciate for everything, and gentlemen, I appreciate you joining me for this episode. Again, if you have anything you want to say about our discussion, if you have any opinions of your own on this film or any of the other films that we have talked about, feel free to hit us up on our Art House Legends Facebook page, or you can get on with us at Twitter at Art House Legends, or if you want to keep it anonymous, you can always email us at arthouselegends@gmail.com. And as usual, if you really want to show some support, go over to iTunes, give us that 5-star review, or give us whatever you think that we deserve. We'll take anything that we can get. But at this point, were there any final words, Kent?
I am the building. Okay.
All right, I'll leave it at that. This is Movie Dare.
Kent.
And fiend.